I made a film for Pep Web on the research of Beatrice Beebe. I made the video for her picture book, Mother-Infant Interaction Picture Book, and various other short films, deep dives into mother-infant dyads that reveal something, let's say, rupture and repair, or various kinds of dyadic interchanges that are available for free on YouTube. So that's another way that I use my analytic self and my documentary self together. And also, I mean, I'm much happier, frankly, with the YouTube films, just because, even though they're less, you know, they're less produced, let's say, because they reach a wide audience. They're for parents, not clinicians. And I want to get the story of this way of thinking or various ways of working or psychoanalysis itself out to the greater public, because I am, you know, such an evangelizer for it. It changed my life in so many ways. And I think it's a very different animal than what the wider world, if they've heard of it at all, thinks that it is. So alive these days, so integrative, and so sort of worthy of letting people know.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Karen Dougherty. Karen Dougherty is a psychoanalyst and a documentary filmmaker. That was her original career, and she describes to us her work in the filmmaking industry, specifically documentaries, with a particular interest and emphasis on cinema verite. And she walks us through how that led her to be interested in the inner workings of the people she got to know and as a filmmaker, and her wanting to explore them and engage with them more deeply, and that led her to train as an analyst. We discuss the similarities and differences that she finds between the ears of an analyst and the eyes of a filmmaker, and there are both similarities and differences. She shares with us the sense that many people she interviews on film develop a transference to the camera. She talks to us about how documentarians are often drawn to trauma, which is a mixed blessing. And she treats many of these people, and she shares with us a composite clinical vignette about what she's been able to learn and help them with their intense, often over-involvement in trauma. She has, since 2022, she has been a member of the IPA think tank on the resolution of intractable conflict, for which she produces a YouTube channel. She is the recipient of a PepWeb video grant. She has made several films on the research of Dr. Beatrice Beebe for clinicians and parents. And she continues to collaborate on documentary projects as a researcher and story consultant. And she currently is both a communications consultant for psychoanalytic organizations and a mental health consultant for film and television. And we close with her sharing recommendations for us about how we can use YouTube to do a better job in letting the world know about what psychoanalysis can offer many individuals who otherwise haven't heard of it. I learned a great deal from this conversation and was inspired to appreciate how important it is to reach out to the community at large. Here is my conversation with Karen Dougherty. Karen, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you.
Thank you.
Karen, I have heard from numbers of individuals who describe to me how deeply and importantly they experience their lives changing as a result of their analytic experiences. And it's always a nice thing to hear that. But they sometimes couple it with the statement that, you know, I wish I had begun my treatment earlier. And they go on to say, with a little bit of a chiding voice, that me and or the field really hasn't done enough to let the public know about psychoanalysis and specifically the unique training that analysts go through. Because they tell me that it was really random luck that found them in their analyst office. And they bemoan the fact that it would have been just as likely that they never found themselves in that office. And in fact, many of them had been in many other offices before they had the treatment that they found so meaningful. Now, you know, those are good news, bad news stories. It's so nice to hear people doing well. But I think, however overdetermined their imagining is, that it would have been better to start it earlier. On a reality level, I think we have to take it also at face value. Now, we know that. We, the field, knows that. Certainly from the IPA perspective, we are very active in that. We have a vigorous communications committee that does a number of outreach efforts, this podcast being one of them. But of course, we always need to be thinking of doing more, which leads me to you. You were and are a documentary filmmaker. And at the end of our conversation, I'm going to ask you to help us out, to talk to us about how, with that mindset of yours, you can advise us, institutes, national analytic organizations, how we can let people know about the work we do so that it isn't just randomly that people find themselves in an analyst's office, but it's purposeful. But we'll get to that. I want to start us off with your journey. You know, among the many pleasures I have in speaking to our colleagues, I've spoken to many who have made journeys from other fields into our field. And everybody has a unique story. And I know you do as well. And I'm going to invite you to share it with our listeners. You started out as a documentary filmmaker, and specifically in the world of cinema verite, which I will also ask you to detail for us. But let me turn it over to you and tell us about your journey.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, the story of any psychoanalyst. Where do you start? You kind of have to start two generations back. You can start a lot of places. But if we're just thinking about sort of the storytelling aspect of my journey, which is, you know, it's story that brought me to psychoanalysis. I guess it starts with really just imbibing stories as a kid, as a child out in rural Ontario. We happened to have a wonderful library. I'm not sure who was responsible for it, but bless them. And I used to read every single biography I could get my hands on, you know? So people's stories opened up the whole world to me. You know, I was reading Helen Keller and Annie Sullivan. I was reading about Amelia Earhart, Madame Curie, you know, all these women who had done these marvelous things. And eventually, just to kind of do an edit in my story, I end up in doing literature at the master's degree level, you know. So my background, my training is in English literature and Canadian literature, the Romantics, and so on. And, you know, when you graduate with a graduate degree in literature, you can either be a professor or you can do something else. So I did something else and I joined a public television station, not knowing where I was going to go from there. And immediately discovered documentary. I hadn't known about what documentaries really before then, what they were. And the folks who ran that public educational broadcaster here in Ontario showed marvelous films from the 60s, the 70s, the beginnings of cinema verite and observational documentary, you know, fly on the wall stuff. And I was...
Spend a moment, if you will, because many of our listeners will and many will not really have a nuanced understanding of cinema verite. I didn't. I read about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, up until the sort of late 50s, early 60s, sound equipment is, you know, and film equipment are very cumbersome. So you're setting, if you're doing some documentary at that point, you know, you're really just filming action, somebody fishing, somebody walking, somebody, you know, very little sound. But at the beginning of the 60s, late 50s, early 60s, the camera equipment becomes more lightweight, more portable. And there's a move towards innovation in synchronized sound. And so now you can kind of use it as an eye on, you know, an unobtrusive kind of observing eye. And you can capture all kinds of slices of life that you couldn't before. And so the filmmakers who were creating this, the Maisels brothers in New York, D.A. Pennybaker, Wolf Koenig up here in Canada, and a man named Alan King up here in Canada, were on the phone with each other, helping each other figure out these innovations of, you know, the film equipment, the sound equipment, where they can be a fly on the wall and find a story and show you something about life that you'd never seen before, that you maybe suspected or intuited, but, you know, just really interesting ways of telling stories and showing dynamics, group dynamics, and the unconscious, you know, the stuff is all kind of coming to the fore with this group of filmmakers. So Alan King, maybe I can just tell you about Alan.
Yes.
King.
Yeah.
Alan King is really the godfather, the grandfather of documentary film in Canada, and happened to meet him when we were doing a retrospective of his work in the 90s at this public television station, TV Ontario. And it was, you know, we were showing all of his kind of famous films. One was called Warrendale, set in a home for emotionally disturbed children in Toronto in 1967, I believe. A married couple about a family, mother, father, baby, Oedipal triangle here also in Toronto, and other films that were just marvelous, you know, observational films where there's no interviews, you know, there's just a camera capturing life and filming over hours and hours and days and weeks waiting for something to happen. So I was watching these films because I was doing the promotion and publicity at the time for documentary. And I got a chance to kind of spend time with Alan King and watch all of his films and write about them for the publicity and drive him around from place to place for interviews for this retrospective. We were showing Warrendale, the one about the emotionally disturbed children's home, for the first time on Canadian television. It had been commissioned in the 60s, and then it was too hot to handle. So the CBC, our national broadcaster, shelved it. It was too much. It was way too emotional. There was swearing. There was all kinds of...
is this still available for people to watch?
It is.
Can you get it on the net? It's called Warrendale, Warrendale.
That's right.
Okay.
And so that film in particular really struck a chord with me, and Alan could see that. You know, every time I watched the trailer, I would sort of tear up, or he knew that something was going on in me. And all the chances that he was such a warm, lovely, humane human, Alan King. And eventually he said to me, you know, Karen, I believe you're a psychoanalyst. And I said, I don't know what that is. What is that? You know? And he said, I'd like you to, he gave me a card of a man. He said, I want you to go talk to this man and tell him that I sent you. I believe that you're destined to be a psychoanalyst. Which is kind of extraordinary. I mean, I was 26 years old. I'm not the only person for whom he did that. People are editors and directors and journalists and so on, because Alan did that kind of an intervention, because he was so attuned to folks. So I went and I met with the man who, it turned out, was Alan's analyst. I didn't know that. He'd been in analysis with this gentleman for a couple of decades at that point here in Toronto. And we spoke, and he asked me a few kind of mystifying, Bionian, mystical sort of questions. And he said, yes, I think Alan's right. And I think, you know, I'd like to help you out. And so he did. He gave me some advice, some suggestions, and also later became my analyst, my first analyst. And my sort of path continued in documentary, where I became a producer at that TVO public television station, and then an independent producer and director, but also began pursuing not training yet, because I still had to do, you know, I went and did a master's in psychoanalytic studies at Sheffield in the UK. I went to lots of seminars and conferences, A.K. Rice conferences, understanding sort of group dynamics, steeped myself in psychoanalysis as I continued to make my way as a burgeoning filmmaker in the documentary field here in Canada, where I was working on social issue films, history documentaries, anything that at a certain point that would pay the bills and maintain my interest. And so it was really twin paths. And eventually I started the training at the TICP, which is the Toronto Institute for Contemporary Psychoanalysis here in Toronto. And then I switched and went over to the TIP, which is the Toronto Institute for Psychoanalysis, the older institute, thought of as a kind of more rigid Freudian institute, which it of course isn't, and did the training there and finished 4 years ago. So and I continue to make documentaries and continue to use my documentary training as a psychoanalyst, and use my psychoanalytic understanding to help filmmakers. You know, it's a lot of crossovers.
That's what I'm particularly curious about. So you use your documentary mindset to listen to patients, and you use your analytic mindset to make documentaries. Help us get a feel for what that is. How would you characterize the two mindsets, especially verite, which, from what I understand, is a form of letting the action take place, but not excluding the observer, unlike direct documentary. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Alan King talked about the, you know, the lens of the camera, the documentary lens, as a kind of psychoanalytic observer. He thought of the lens as a psychoanalyst. And the reason that he did is because it's sort of, you know, it's unobtrusive, it's maintaining a kind of evenly hovering attention, it's non-judgmental, it waits, And it and then it also, you know, he didn't think this at first, but later, you know, it also intervenes. And there's a transference to it by the observed, by the subjects. They think about that lens. They think about that eye. They use it as in many ways, the same way they use us as, you know, our patients use us as psychoanalysts. They transfer all sorts of things onto us, and we frame and we contain, and that's what the camera does. So I think my way of listening as a filmmaker is very similar to my way of listening as an analyst. My goal is different, but my way is, there are many similarities. I use that training a lot, and also to listen for whatever it is I'm listening for, you know? Yeah.
Now, you also do consultantships. You bring your analytic skill to working with filmmakers.
Yes, and that can be in a very, very, you know, sort of obvious ways, like a filmmaker colleague of mine is making a film about suicide and the those who survived, you know, the those left behind by people who commit suicide, and contacted me for consultation about resources they could offer viewers, not just viewers, but also the crew, because documentary film crews, we work in trauma a lot. And so there's a lot of vicarious trauma and not a lot of historic support or help in holding the crew in a certain way without venturing into being the crew's therapist, right?
Mm. So it's boundary setting as well.
Very, very important, because again, especially in this, the kind of documentary that I've been a part of mostly, where you're telling a story often of a traumatized or, harmed individual, you're with them for a year or 2 years. And so you can see that the filmmaker can become very intertwined or enmeshed in the life of that person, and become a kind of a therapist without the training. Mm. And that happens a lot. I have patients who are filmmakers, and who require this kind of help in understanding. It's more than ethics, right? It's how do I, if I myself as a filmmaker, many of the, just as many psychoanalysts come from trauma, so do many filmmakers, you know, so they want to heal, they want to fix, and they often get too involved. And so how to extricate, how to release themselves of the guilt, as if they're responsible for the life of the person whose story they have used in order to tell a larger story. You know, it's pretty complex.
I was interested in your observation that documentary filmmakers are often drawn to documenting trauma because they themselves carry that with them. I never put the two together until you had mentioned that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was certainly Alan King's story. There's a great film about him. I can't remember the name right now, that John Hazlitt-Cuff and Sonny Yee made, a film about Alan King's life. And yes, his story was a difficult one. He had a difficult childhood. And so, yeah, many, as you know, many activists, right, come from some kind of very traumatic upbringing, and they use their trauma in the service of making change. They use their anger and their anguish to make change. Many filmmakers are kind of activists at heart. Yeah, they want to change the world. I mean, that's certainly what drew me to documentary, that it was a way not just to document, but to make change in the world, in the subject. Just the act of telling their story often is very change-making, as we know as psychoanalysts, and in the life of the filmmaker. You know, the best documentaries change all three of those, the filmmaker, the subject, and the audience, right?
And yet it's an interesting challenge. We as analysts, if we come with a preordained notion of how we want to change a patient, or even broader, how we want that changed patient to change their larger community, that can sometimes interfere with our really being with them wherever they are and wherever they're going. Is that ever true, do you find, with documentarians, that their zeal can interfere with their listening?
I think so. I think the more sort of activist films can slide into that. That's why I love these kinds of verite or direct cinema obs doc approaches, because they kind of hang back and they find the story in the edit suite. Huh. They don't have an idea of what the story's going to be.
Right.
They find it later going through 200 hours of footage and trying to piece together something that was told to them by the action over time.
That's like our listening to the latent theme in the associations.
Yes.
It sounds like exactly the same process, right?
Exactly. Yeah, very much the directing of these kinds of documentaries mostly kind of takes place in the edit suite.
Huh.
You know, it's not, if you think about, you know, drama or, you know, film directing, what you often see is a director deciding what's going to be shot and pointing the camera and directing the action. That's the opposite of this. There is no directing the action, or very little. In really direct cinema is what Alan King and the Maisels are doing. Direct cinema being different because they think that they're not causing or creating the story. They're there for the story, whereas cinema verite is a little bit more, the tradition is a little bit more kind of making something happen on film. Yeah.
It seems that one of the differences between filmmaking and analysis is the relative balance of verbal versus nonverbal communication. That documentaries are by definition essentially visual, and the attunement is visual. And analysis obviously includes that, but it doesn't bias in favor of that compared to the listening and the tones and the music. Mm. Is that a fair observation?
Yeah, I would say so. And I would say, yeah, it's, you know, there's very little in this kind of filmmaking, almost no music. Which is interesting, just to add to what you've just said, because adding music is telling you, the viewer, something about how to feel. And but yes, I mean, we're it is visual, and a lot of what happens, you know, Alan King was the master at capturing the unconscious on film. Frankly, if you watch his films. A Married Couple, Warren Dale, Who's in Charge, which was based on an A.K. Rice, you know, Tavistock model of group relations. Nobody else could do it like he did it. And sometimes it's in what people say, but mostly, yes, it's in how people are non-verbally communicating on film.
Hmm.
You know? So interesting to watch them. I'm preparing a course right now, an extension course for our society on this kind of documentary, where we're actually, there are two other documentary psychoanalytic therapists at my institute, you know, at my society. One's a candidate, one's did the 2-year program. And we're sort of co-teaching this course to really help people to understand how psychoanalysis and documentary lend so much to each other.
Yeah. Dare I ask, is it going to be online?
It is online.
It is online. So if people listening to this wanted to either live or on tape tune into this course, would that be available to them? Or is that something?
They won't be able to do it on tape, but they can do it live. And it's, you know, there's one, we're doing Grey Gardens, which is the Maisels Brothers, starting September 13th.
Uh-huh.
Then we're going to be doing, what are we doing? Oh, we're going to be doing Alan King's A Married Couple. So we're having guest discussants, and often it's the filmmaker or the editor. So for A Married Couple, Alan King's editor, Nick Hector, is the guest discussant. And we have the maker of Hoop Dreams. I don't know if you know that documentary. It won an Oscar. Following over 5 years, these young African-American men who are trying to be basketball stars. And it's really the story of mothers and sons, single mothers and sons. So we're showing his film, Stevie. Steve James is the filmmaker. He's coming. So it's going to be a great course, and it'll be a multi-year course. And people can sign up by going to the Toronto Psychoanalytic Society website. Terrific. And I will have lots of really neat people taking the course, from filmmakers to academics to clinicians, you know.
Sure.
To film lovers.
You have a composite case that you can share with us that really brings to the fore the skills both in, from your film world and your analytic world. Can you tell us about that person?
Right. So, you know, 50-something filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, who's made many films about many difficult topics, some of which are related to death, people who are dying, but also people who are oppressed in different ways, and came because of absolute overwhelm and stress, and really kind of depression as well, vicarious trauma. And I get many patients like this, and the work, as I mentioned before, you know, the work with many of these patients is to help them sort out, first of all, what's going on, where the boundaries are, but where this comes from in their own history, in their own childhood experience, in their own family, to be the person who gets too involved and tries to heal, because these filmmakers get too involved, this particular filmmaker, too involved in the life of the subject, to the point where they're, you know, they're becoming their therapist, helping them financially sometimes if they're, you know, and just really going overboard and becoming almost masochistically sacrificial, right? And so it's the work is to kind of help sort out what happened in their history to, you know, have them be in this kind of arrangement again and again with their subjects, and to understand and work on their guilt. And understand that it's really not their, it's not their job. It's not their job to fix or heal or become the therapist of their patients. And this is difficult. And it's actually, you know, one of the reasons that I became a psychoanalyst is because there wasn't enough opportunity to help, you know, as a journalist. You have to kind of step back, and, you know, I would think, wow, like that person just told me a story they've never told anyone before. They've opened up a can of worms, and now I can see that they're really ready to kind of do the real work, you know. And actually, it is the case that for the filmmaker I was just talking about, now what she does is she helps people, subjects, if she sees them in this situation, to find someone who can work with them. So it's a kind of gateway. Being a documentary subject becomes a gateway to psychoanalytic psychotherapy. This is some kind of mental health intervention, let's say, psychoanalysis even.
Do you notice that as they free themselves from their past templates that they're bringing to their current work, that their work deepens in the filmmaking?
It deepens in the filmmaking, but it also makes them second guess whether or not they themselves should be a therapist. And that's what happened with this particular patient that I'm talking about. It happens because, again, the, you know, documentary, it's wonderful. And as I've said, people start it, you know, into that field because they want to change the world, but that's a fantasy.
Right.
But what we can do as therapists, as psychoanalysts, is make modest, bit by bit, day by day, change in ourselves, our patients, and so on over time, long time. Like, these films are shot over time, and I think probably they do have an effect on the subject as a result of being interested in the subject for that long. But the films themselves don't. Very rarely do they make real social change. Mm-hmm. Frankly, this is my feeling.
Though there is that expression, you change one person, you change the world too.
Yeah. I mean, I feel much more, I feel like I'm engaging much more with that part of myself that wants to make change or help or heal, right, as a psychoanalyst, as a therapist, than I ever did as a filmmaker.
How gratifying that must be for you.
Really great. And, you know, you asked me too, like how I kind of fold these two worlds or these two ways. And I've made a bunch of films about the work of, for example, the work of Beatrice Beebe. Beatrice Beebe, wonderful psychoanalyst and researcher at Columbia University, who does mother-infant face-to-face communication video microanalysis research. That's a mouthful, but that's what it is. And I met her when I was training at the TICP. So I was at the TICP, the Toronto Institute of Contemporary Psychoanalysis, really the relational institute here. It's not IPA, it's but it's affiliated, you know, sort of more with the American relational model. And so Beatrice was one of the big speaker that we was brought in for a weekend here in Toronto. And my class was very lucky to have her teach us on the Friday night before her big sold out show. Mm-hmm. And I came in last that evening. I happened to be the last person in the room. Everyone else, and of course, at the time, I didn't know anything really about psychoanalysis. I didn't know who she was, but my classmates did. And everyone was very intimidated. And so there was a seat empty next to her because everybody was so scared of her, I think, because she's a heavy hitter. Mm-hmm. And so I sat beside her, and luckily for me, I did, because for the rest of the evening, as she was demonstrating her work, you know, mother-infant face-to-face communication, I was the mother to her baby or the baby to her mother. She used me. She said, "Can I use your face?" And so we imprinted on each other by the end of the night. And
nice, yeah.
And also she showed, you know, lab footage. And I said to her at the end, "You know, I'm a filmmaker. I just want to tell you, you should be making a film. I mean, you've got 40 years of lab footage, and you know, the roots of attachment are all right here for the taking, you know, for the seeing." And she said, "Give me a call." And that's how generous she is with her work. And so I did. I reached out to her and I applied for a PepWeb video grant, and I got it. And I made a film for PepWeb. On the research of Beatrice Beebe, I made the video for her picture book, Mother Infant Interaction Picture Book, and various other short films, deep dives into mother infant dyads that reveal something, let's say, rupture and repair, or various kinds of dyadic interchanges that are available for free on YouTube. So that's another way that I use my analytic self and my documentary self together to, and also, I mean, I'm much happier, frankly, with the YouTube films, just because, even though they're less, you know, they're less produced, let's say.
Right.
Because they reach a wide audience. They're for parents, not clinicians. And I want to get the story of this way of thinking, or, you know, various ways of working, or psychoanalysis itself, out to the greater public, because I am, you know, such an evangelizer for it. It changed my life in so many ways. And I think it's a very different animal than what the wider world, if they've heard of it at all, thinks that it is. So alive these days, so integrative, so sort of worthy of letting people know, as you sort of set out early on, letting people know about.
How would people find these films on YouTube? What would they search under?
They can just search under Dr. Beatrice Beebe, okay. B-E-E-B-E, Beebe, who works with babies. Uh-huh. And she has a YouTube channel. And, you know, YouTube is fantastic for psychoanalysis. You know, you can do all kinds of things that reach a very wide audience. And it's another part of my, you know, master plan is to help various institutes, think tanks, organizations, psychoanalytic societies get the message out to a wider audience so that people are not, as you said early on, just stumbling upon it randomly, you know, 10, 20 years after they would have liked to have found it.
Right. Well, that's let's return to the beginning. Tell us about if an institute or a national organization came to you and they said, we want to make this more known. How would you advise them?
Well, I'll give you an example of something I'm working on now. I was connected with Harriet Wolf, who's the president of the IPA. Yes. Mm-hmm. And Harriet heard about me through, I'm not even quite sure, maybe Beatrice, maybe the IPA social media committee that I was on. Because she was looking for someone to help get the word out about the work of the think tank that she runs on the resolution of intractable conflict, mm-hmm. which, you know, has, of course, you were at the IPA Congress recently, yes. as I was in Cartagena. I was there filming interviews with members of the of that think tank, of which I am now a member, because I became a member after a while because it was so interesting. It's all John Alderdice.
John Alderdice, yes, right.
Yep, Vera Varvin, Adriana Prengler, Chuck Strozier. I mean, it's a fantastic dream team of people who are thinking and intervening in various ways outside of the clinic, psychoanalytically, to help resolve various kinds of conflict. John Alderdice, as you know, is one of the architects of the Good Friday Agreement.
Yes. And I will link an interview that I did with him on the notes.
Yes, he's a fascinating fellow. With Sver Varvin. Yes,
yes, I interviewed him as well. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, marvelous human working with refugees. So Harriet contacted me. Can you help us maybe make a video? I said, well, I can maybe not make a video, but I'll consult. I'll let you know. I'll tell you some things that you can do. And of course, I got pulled in over time because it's so fascinating. Sure. And now not only am I on the committee, but I'm creating a YouTube channel. I am doing all kinds of interviews with the members of the think tank and beyond, people beyond who are doing interesting work related to the work of the think tank. And so that's a way to get the word out about what those folks are doing to the wider world. And I think people don't, in psychoanalysis, don't enough think about social media and about YouTube. YouTube is taking over. You know, a good documentary, like a really good documentary, can cost upwards of $500,000. YouTube, I used my iPhone and my, Zoom audio recorder. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do it on the fly, and you can be very flexible, and people, viewers, do not expect high production. They need good sound, but they don't mind jump cuts. They don't mind Zoom interviews, as you know, mm-hmm. people are just looking for content. They're looking for all kinds of ways of thinking about the things that they're interested in and finding more things that they're interested in.
I feel more optimistic listening to you describe your various activities than I did when we began this conversation. It sounds like you and Harriet and the group at large is really on top of this challenge, and you're bringing your considerable training and resources to get the word out, if you don't mind that phrase, but to really let people know that there are people with this training and with this experience, and that we can offer them something very valuable in your life. You, as you say, being a living example of that.
Yeah. And, you know, and your podcast is so interesting and important and great for psychoanalysts. I'm also going to be doing just the little, you know, Canadian Psychoanalytic Society podcast, which will be interviewing in French and English, you know, artists, thinkers, activists, politicians, clinicians, writers, you know,
wonderful.
Just from a psychoanalytic perspective, we'll be putting that on the website and driving people via social media to the website. This is a means of hiding medicine in a muffin, sort of getting people to the website so that they can discover psychoanalysis, find a psychoanalyst, find out about training, find out about community events. So as many kind of community events as possible, we're trying to do at the Toronto and the Canadian Psychoanalytic, so that whether it's the Freud Cafe, which is, you know, now an online event for the wider public, or these extension courses, or, you know, we call it community bridges, where we're trying to get as many people as possible to come listen to something that they'll be interested in, and then discover psychoanalysis through that. You see, people. So that's the other pillar of my master plan.
And if somebody who listens to podcasts just on Spotify or Apple, and if they wanted to tune into yours, how would they? What's its name? How would they find it?
Well, it's just in process now. So I think right now the title right now is a working title of Conversations in Psychoanalysis. And it will be on the CPS website. It'll be housed on another sort of podcast server, but you can link to it on the CPS, Canadian Psychoanalytic Society website.
Okay.
And so I'm on that committee. You know, again, I'm on any committee of my institute or my society that is involved in promotion of psychoanalysis, I have joined so that we can up our game, and so we're redoing the CPS website, and this podcast is part of that.
I have to tell you, Karen, as I'm listening to you, I have this broad smile on my face. You may not appreciate the energy, the delightful energy that you bring to this, as I say, in addition to the thoroughness of your skills, but it's a pleasure to learn from you, to listen from you, and to hear your master plan, as it were. But it's more than a master plan. It's an actual plan that I think will reach important numbers of people.
Well, thanks, Harvey. I really appreciate and enjoyed talking with you today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Take care.
Bye. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, We can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.